All right, so here's another one where people have strange interpretations. Ephesians 2, or I should say the church, the Catholic Church and Reformed Church has given it unusual interpretations. But chapter 2 of Ephesians,
15.
yeah, you could probably go 13 through 15. But now in the Messiah Yeshua, you who are once far off have been made near by the blood of Messiah. For he himself is our shalom, who has made both one, has broken down the middle wall of division between us, having abolished in his flesh the enmity, that is, the law of commandments contained in ordinances, so as to create in himself one new man from the two, thus making peace. And he might reconcile them both to Elohim in one body through the cross, thereby putting to death the enmity. Okay, so when you read that, how does it sound like to you? Any?
He made peace by abolishing the law.
That's what it sounds like, doesn't
That's what it
it?
sounds like to me, but I know that's not what it's saying.
Yeah. Yeah, the law of commandments contain ordinances. Now, I know with your King James Version, it might have different italicized words, but I know it has italicized words in there because they added words in order to make that meaning, that implied meaning, come out more like that. Like, for example, in mine, it says, when it says he has broken down the middle wall of division between us is added. Italicized, have abolished in his flesh the enmity, and that is italicized. The law of commandments, then the word contained is italicized, and ordinances, so as to create himself one new man,
Oh, that's right, I know it.
italicized from the two, thus is italicized, making peace. So they had to add a lot, every once in a while, you need to add an italicized word every once in a while to add clarification. But when you add a lot of them like that, it's when the text doesn't make sense by itself, then they add a lot of things to where it actually changes the meaning. But it doesn't always mean that. But in this, it's a red flag. It's something to consider. Why did they add italicized words? Why, in all the other aspects of the translation, do they just use an italicized word here or there for clarification to add smoothness to reading? But here they have like four or five just within a couple of verses. It falls out of the pattern of normalcy for their translation. They have a certain signature to the translation, a certain habit, a certain approach. But here suddenly they're breaking their own pattern of approach. Now they're adding all these words in here. So what's going on? Why are they changing something? Are they trying to hide something? It just kind of makes you suspicious when they're breaking their own routine. These are the clues that I look for, kind of as a contextual detective. I look for breaks and patterns, and then I try and figure out why was the pattern broken. Is it a legitimate break? Is it because they just simply couldn't figure out what it was saying, and so this was their best attempt? Or was it a sabotage? Well, here's a few things. Maybe it was a sabotage, maybe not. I don't know about this one. I know the other one that we just read in Colossians 2, that was definitely a sabotage there. But this one might just be ignorance about some basic ideas that would be very easy for a Jew to recognize. A Jew reading this is how it would sound like. For he, a Jewish believer, I would say, or a Jew in the first century who was a believer in particular, because this actually goes back to the temple. There's a little temple idiom in here. Beginning with 14. For he himself is our shalom, who has made both one, has broken down the Sorig wall, having abolished in his flesh the bitter opposition in the law of commandments contained in ordinances, so as to create himself one new man. So the Sorig wall, what's that? Well, the Sorig wall is a middle wall of partition that was built in the temple to separate the Jews from the Gentiles. See, the Gentiles could come to the temple to worship because it was to be a house of prayer for all nations, and during the feast, Gentiles who were considering their proselytes or considering converting or whatever, so they hadn't officially converted yet, they could come, but they had to stay on the other side of the wall. And if they passed that wall, there was a little sign that said that if they passed that wall, then they would do so on pain of death. and their blood would be on their own head for passing that point, because they were not converted yet, so they weren't allowed to go past that point. But that wall was made by a law of commandments contained in human ordinances, not divine ordinance. The Father, no, you can read all the Torah you want, and you'll never find that middle wall partition of the Torah in the temple that was built. King David and Solomon, when Solomon built the temple, there's no Sorig wall, there's no middle wall partition. When the tabernacle was built, there was no wall separating the Gentiles from the Jewish believers, the Israeli believers. That was built by tradition, because through tradition they felt that if they had Gentiles all past a certain point on the temple mount who had not fully converted, then it would defile the temple. And so it's, okay, well, you can come, but until you're converted, we want you not to go past this point, because we don't want you to defile the temple. But Father never said to build that. But now Yeshua, through his flesh, has abolished, because that created enmity. See, bitter opposition between the Jews and Gentiles. It's like there's always this battle against them. Even though they're trying to convert, they're becoming proselytes, they want to become Jewish people themselves, but yet there's this, oh, well, you're just a Gentile, you're not one of us yet. And then the Gentiles are like, well, you know, we're trying to be one of you, and why are you treating us like this? And, you know, so you have that opposition with each other, those little nuances of prejudice and biases that make that coming together a little difficult. So here, he has broken down that Sorig wall that was built through human ordinances. He abolished through his flesh that bitter opposition between the two of us, thereby creating in himself, through his body, one new man, thereby making peace between us, that he might reconcile both of us to Elohim into one body through the execution stake, thereby putting to death that bitter opposition between us, Jews and Gentiles. See, that's all that's saying. It has nothing to do with the law of ordinances. The law of commands contain ordinances. That's the key word. If you go to the Greek, it's human ordinances, not divine.
So when it says law of commandments, it says human ordinances?
Yeah, the law of commandments in ordinances. Mm-hmm.
That's human.
Human ordinances. The law of commandments in human ordinances.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. So it's not talking about the Torah, because the Torah is not a human ordinance. That was divine origin, came out of the mouth of Yehovah himself.
Wow.
And then it goes on. And he came and preached shalom to you who were far off and those who were near. For through him we both have access by one spirit to the Father. So he's talking about the access. That was the whole problem with the Sorig wall, is it prevented access for the Gentiles. It was unequal access. You know, Jews could go this far, but Gentiles could only go this far. So they were limited in their access. And that's what this is talking about, that now through Messiah we both have access, in verse 18, by one Spirit to the Father. Now therefore, you Gentiles, you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens. See? Fellow citizens of the saints and members of the household of Yehovah. So that's what Yeshua is doing there. So again, you have temple language in here, but it's lost in the translations. But when you read the writings of Paul in the New Testament in general, not the Gospels so much, the Gospel talks about the temple plenty of times, but it seems like that after the book of Acts, from Romans all the way to the end, it's almost as if they act like there's no temple. You would think it doesn't exist anymore, because the way they translate it, there's no debates or anything, but you think about it, how can a Messiah come and atone for our sins, which would take us away from the need for animal sacrifices, and then there would be no controversy over it? It would be impossible to avoid controversy. There would be all kinds of disputes arising. Just imagine consider the disputes that arose just over the Sabbath alone. Yeshua wasn't even breaking the Sabbath. He was only breaking some halakha of various Jewish sects concerning how the Sabbath should be carried out. So one sect, you know, like the Pharisees, would say, well, if you went out and you took some grain off on the Sabbath and you rubbed it in your hands like that to take the hole off it, well, that was processing the food. Therefore, you're working on the Sabbath because you're processing the food. And Yeshua clarified, no, that's not a correct interpretation. It says, scriptures say, the Torah says, that on the Sabbath you can go out in the field and you can take off and you can eat the food. You just cannot put it into a basket and then carry it off with you. Now that's processing according to the Torah. But human traditions, oral traditions, had developed that, fine-tuned that to the point to where they lost the intent of the law. to where, well, if you can't even rub it, then if you're a poor person, you're hungry, and you want to go out in the field and just grab something to eat, well, how are you going to eat something that has a hole, like, you know, barley or something? You have to get that little outer, it's not necessarily the hole. Well, maybe it's a hole. I don't know the farming terms quite precise, but it's that little thin thing on there. You just gently rub it. It comes right off. I've actually rubbed it before. It just pops right up, and then you can eat it. And whatever that little thin covering is, like maybe it's a hole, maybe it's a different name for it. That the husk. Okay, the husk. Yeah. See, that's not a process. It's just very gentle. It doesn't take a lot of work at all. And you do it, and it pops right out, and then you eat it, and it actually tastes pretty good. And that's all Yeshua was doing. And so, but that was not violating the Sabbath. It was violating the halakha of the Pharisees concerning their interpretation of the Sabbath. But then you have the Sadducees. They might have had a different perspective on it. And the ones down the Dead Sea, I can't remember their names, the Essenes, they might have had even yet a third interpretation of what you can do on the Sabbath and not do. So they all developed their own halakha. And the halakha is how to walk out the commandments in areas that are not necessarily clear. They would put those above the written word of God, of Elohim. So those are just two examples there. But now, let's go to one. My wife was reminding me that one of the reasons why Yeshua had to rebuke the Pharisees is because, well, they weren't fair, you see. And the Sadducees, you know, they were a little upset by what Yeshua did because they were sad, you see.
I see.
Yeah.
And the Essenes.
And the Essenes, I don't know how that one fits. There's, I don't know, play of words on that one. But if you go to Hebrews chapter 10, there's a little thing here because I've done a translation on the book of Hebrews and I've done a partial on Romans and I've done a translation on Hebrews, Galatians, and part of Romans, and then some other minor places, partial places where the Torah was needed to be clarified what was being said about the Torah.
Colossians,
yeah. So those two passages that we just went over, I have translations of those, and someday, Father willing, I'll work it into a complete translation of the Brit Hadashah through the eyes of a Levite. And
The New Testament?
Yeah, the New Testament, yes. But these are some of the things that led me to my translation of Galatians. Because as you read through many of Paul's writings, you find the word law used continuously. And sometimes the law is being presented in a positive light, like when Paul says, the law is perfect, or the law is holy and just and good. Okay, so in that case, he's upholding it. But there's other times when he makes comments about, well, we're saved by grace, not by works of the law, and so on and so forth. And so that would have a negative connotation. And so, well, how can he uphold it on one hand and cut it down on the other hand? Is it because he's schizophrenic, or is it because he's talking about two different laws? Well, I don't believe he's schizophrenic, so that must mean that he's talking about more than one law. And so then you have to look at the context, and the context will give a clues as to what kind of law is being spoken about. And the Greek is actually much more clear. It's not precisely clear. You still have to do a little bit of research and contextual observation and evaluation in order to tell which laws are talked about. But the Greek is more clear, especially about the law of Moses. It will say nomos for the law given through Moses, or anomos for, you know, being against it, or anti-law or whatever. But in the English, it's totally obscured. I mean, every incident, whether it's human law, divine law, diabolical law, temple law, it just uses the same word law. So you just have no idea which law is being talked about in the New Testament, apart from really studying out the context of the passage. And even that alone doesn't always answer the question directly. So it's what you have to do then, is you have to look at other scriptures that use the word law in a similar way, and then compare it to other scriptures that use it in a similar way, in order to find more clues. And then once you find the clues, then you can discern more directly which law is being spoken about. So here's one thing. We can go to Galatians. Let's go to Galatians. I'll give you one example of this. Galatians 3. No, just read the whole chapter. It's just, you can hear the law used in so many different ways here. 3:1, O foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you that you should not obey the truth, before whose eyes the Messiah Yeshua is clearly betrayed among you as crucified? This only I want to learn from you. Did you receive the Spirit by the works of the law, or by the hearing of faith? Are you so foolish? Having begun in the Spirit, are you now being made perfect by the flesh? Have you suffered so many things in vain, if indeed it was in vain? Therefore he who supplies the Spirit to you and works miracles among you, does he do it by the works of the law, or by the hearing of faith? For just as Abraham believed Elohim, and it was accounted to him as righteousness, therefore know that only those who are of faith are sons of Abraham. And the Scripture, foreseeing that Elohim would justify the nations by faith, preached the gospel to Abraham beforehand, saying, in you all the nations shall be blessed. So then those who are of the faith are blessed with believing Abraham. For as many are of the works of the law are under the curse. For it is written, curses everyone who does not continue in all the things which are written in the book of the law to do them. But that no one is justified by the law in the sight of Elohim is evident, for the just shall live by faith. Yet the law is not of faith, but the man who does them shall live by them. So Messiah has redeemed us from the curse of the law, having become a curse for us. As it is written, curses everyone who hangs on a tree, so that the blessings of Abraham might come upon the Gentiles and the Messiah Yeshua, that we might receive the promise of the Spirit through faith. Okay, so that sounded like a lot of negative stuff about the law. But pay attention. The key, it says works of the law. So that's a little clue there. Works of the law. It's not just saying the law, it's saying the works of the law. Now, brethren, I speak in the manner of men. Though it is only a man's covenant, yet if it is confirmed, no one annuls or adds to it. Now to Abraham and his seed were the promises made. Now he does not say, and to seeds, as of many, but as of one, and to your seed, who is the Messiah. And this I say, that the law, which is 430 years later, cannot annul the covenant that was confirmed before by Elohim and Messiah, that it should make the promise of no effect. For if the inheritance is of the law, it is no longer a promise. So there's evidence of the dietary laws before Mount Sinai and even before Abraham. What about the ceremonial laws? What does it say with Laban? He came looking for his idol that Rachel had taken. So what did Rachel do? It hid under her saddle. And when Laban came in the tent and started looking around, what'd she say? Oh, well, I'm sorry. I can't get up. I'm on my period right now. And Laban goes, oh, okay. And so he looks everywhere else except the part where she was sitting, because she was on her period. He knew he couldn't touch that.
Yeah, and she actually said that.
She said it. Yeah, I'm on my period. I'm sorry, I can't get up. So there it is. There's an example of ceremonial law before Mount Sinai and even before Abraham. Or actually, that one was after Abraham, but still it's before Mount Sinai. Okay, what about what was the other category? Oh, and then of course moral laws. Well, there's all kinds of moral laws in the Old Testament. We don't even need to look far for those. That was kind of logical. That we've always had moral laws that we needed to abide by. And then you could maybe talk about the feast days. Well, there it is. The 7 day of creation, the Sabbath was being celebrated. And right there in Genesis chapter 1, Bereshit chapter 1, he says, let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons, for days and years. This in the Hebrew literally reads, let them be for signals and for the Moedim, for the appointed times, to signal the appointed times. So right in the very beginning, he already ordained the sun and the moon in order to dictate when the appointed times and seasons should begin. So we have evidence for that in the very beginning, even concerning the set apart times that we celebrate. So we find evidence of all these other laws way before Mount Sinai, and some of them even before Abraham. What we don't find is the Levitical priesthood. So we're narrowing it down pretty firmly. This is being firmed up pretty soundly that the Levitical priesthood is what's being spoken about in Galatians. It's the only thing that was added 430 years later that wasn't there prior. And it's the only thing that's not there today. Because if you go into the future, it talks about the dietary laws right there in Isaiah 66, when it says that when he comes, whoever is eating pig's flesh or the abomination of the mouse, that they shall be altogether consumed. Okay, so there's an example of the dietary laws. Oh, here it is. Yeah, the one when Babylon's. Excuse me, I had the wrong passage.
Revelation what?
Revelation 18, when it talks about Babylon falling. And in verse 2, it says, Babylon the Great is fallen, and has become a habitation of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. So in the future, it's still talking about that there's unclean birds. And then another part where it talks about when the demons go out to deceive the kings of the earth, that they go out in the appearance of frogs, unclean spirits and frogs. So those are still related as unclean. So we have these things in the future that still being called unclean. And then, of course, we have the Corinthians text we talked about. You know, it's still present tense. There's still uncleanness. And Paul says if we have this ceremony uncleanness, that it will prevent us from going into the kingdom. The dietary, the feast days, and talks about our shadow of things yet to come. Well, that tells us there's going to be things to come in the future. So again, but is there a Levitical priesthood in the future? No. There's a priesthood at the order of Melchizedek, and there are Levites part of it, but it's not the Levitical order. It's a different order of priesthood. So even though there's Levites within it, it's not the Levitical order. So again, everything matches.
And where's that one about that? Everybody will go up.
Yeah, everyone goes to Jerusalem for the feast. So, okay, so the feasts are in the past, the feasts are in the future.
Where's that at?
Okay. Zechariah and Isaiah 66 and Zechariah 14. So, with something that was added 430 years later, and that led us to Messiah as a tutor, and we're no longer under it, therefore implying that it is no longer in existence. And we've narrowed that down to the Levitical priesthood. So, now if we go to Hebrews, we have an idea of what this phrase, works of the law, might be talking about. And what the word law is talking about within the context of the passage that is talking about works of the law. So, Hebrews 10. Because Hebrews 10 uses the word law. Where sometimes when Paul's writing law is referring to human law, sometimes referring to the law of Yehovah, sometimes it's referring to the law of sin. So there's different kinds of laws. But Hebrews specifically uses law this way. Hebrews 10 verse 1. Okay, so 10:1 uses the word law in this context. For the law, having a shadow of the good things to come, and not the very image of things, can never with these same sacrifices, which offer continually year by year, make those who approach perfect. So voila, this is relating the law specifically to the sacrifices. So now we have a key that shows us that sometimes when the word law is being used in the New Testament, it is being used to refer to the sacrificial system after the order of Levi. And this one's a very good key because it's right in the context of the book of Hebrews, which in its entirety, almost in its entirety, is about the change of priesthoods from the Levitical order to the Melchizedek order of priesthood. So the change in law was a change in the priesthood law. See? Not a change in the moral law, not a change in the dietary law, not a change in the feasthood, in the feast day law, to go from his feast to pagan festivals. Right? It's not a change in the ceremonial law. It's a change in the priesthood law. a change in that which was added 430 years later, which is now reverting back to the original Melchizedek order. See? It's just restored to the original order of priesthood. There was one man as priest over his own family. The Levitical priesthood was an army of priests over the family of Israel. Because it's too large, it's too many people for one man to atone for. See? One man, Moses would have, or Aaron would have been up there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all year around, never be able to sleep even so much as a minute, having to offer up sacrifices on behalf of a nation that large, and he still wouldn't be able to keep up. He'd fall behind. See, there needed to be an army of priests to atone for a family of several million people. 600,000 men, and then you count the women and children, probably 2-3 million people possibly.